It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Maria's out sick this week.
And she's out sick. All right. Well, we're going to have to hold down the fort then. So
I have my hammers and nails.
Okay, because I'm putting you on sandbag duty.
There's been a lot of that going around lately.
Yeah, sandbagging. All right, well, plenty to cover. Let's start with local city council. Looks like they passed a budget.
Yeah, the budget committee, not the whole city council, but the budget committee passed a budget this week on Wednesday, and it'll go to the full city council for pretty routine approval. The major decisions were made in the budget committee, and this was making changes and amendments to Greg Nichols' budget, which he presented to the city council in September. One of the major changes, probably the biggest, is adding $2.5 million for Seattle Public Libraries to have longer hours and more branches open on Sunday. In fact, all of the branches should be open on Sunday with this budget, restoring funding to the 1999 levels. There had been cuts in several recent years, and when those cuts were made in 2002, 2003, 2004, Nichols promised that the funding would be restored once the city had more money. Well, this year the city had more money, and the funding was not restored. In fact, Nichols didn't have a nickel to put in for the library. And so the library, Deborah Jacobs, the head librarian there, and the Seattle Public Library Foundation started to do a lobby campaign. They sent out mass emails to their supporters. Peter Steinbrook and Gene Godden on the city council started lobbying the rest of the city council to restore the funding, and they were successful, and a lot of people in the public mobilized to try and get that funding for the library. So that's that was good news. There were a couple of other minor additions to the budget that are worth talking about. There was $628,000 that was put in to study possible replacements for the Green Line public transit to help out West Seattle and Ballard now that the Seattle Monorail project is history. And then there was another $350,000 to put in for additional shelter beds for the homeless. This, again, was another promise of the Nichols administration that that they reneged on this year. It's not enough to prevent a net loss of shelter beds, at least according to homeless advocates, but it will certainly help. So, by and large, good news in the budget passing this year. No major cuts of any kind. The city has more revenue than it expected to have, particularly because of real estate excise taxes going up. So we're in good shape.
Okay. Well, jumping from there to national, looks like Bob Woodward this week joined Judith Miller in an exclusive club there for the well-to-do reporters.
Yeah, anybody who has been reading me for a while knows what I think of Bob Woodward. I did reviews for both of his Bush books, Plan of Attack and Bush at War. He's unfortunately, given the credibility he has due to his heritage from Watergate, he has basically become a stenographer to the rich and powerful. Both books chronicled the Bush administration without any context, without challenging any of their claims, basically just wrote down what they had to say and who attended what meetings when. It was really stenographic journalism at its worst. And the last of the two books describing the run-up to the Iraq War was the book that he was working on when he learned the identity of Valerie Wilson from a now undisclosed White House official. It wasn't Louis Libby. Bush and Cheney and most of their senior aides have all denied that that they were the source for this. So somebody is lying. But the real question is why Woodward would withheld this information even from his own editors, let alone the investigation into the leak, let alone the public for the last 2.5 years. Woodward said that he didn't tell anybody because he was working on his book and he didn't want to have to testify before a grand jury. Well, you know, obviously as a citizen, you have an obligation when you're aware of a crime to testify before a grand jury and to tell authorities. So that is really a pretty weak comeback. But it's also patently untrue because a grand jury wasn't actually impaneled at the time. Wilson was Wilson's identity was leaked to Woodward, which was about a full month before other journalists had learned the identity from Libby and Rove and various other White House aides. The grand jury was not impaneled for 6 months after that. So the question is, why didn't he at the time when it was a story, when once Novak printed the identity of Valerie Wilson in his column on July 28th, 2003, why Woodward didn't say at that point that that I was contacted by White House officials and told Wilson's identity as well. If he had done that at the time, you could start connecting the dots and concluding that there was an organized campaign underway at the White House to discredit Joseph Wilson, the ex-ambassador, and also again to prosecute a crime of leaking the identity of a covert CIA operative. So Woodward, by withholding the information, really acted to protect his buddies in the Bush administration. There's just absolutely no excuse for it.
And then connected that, I understand that Fitzgerald is looking at putting together another grant.
He's done it. He went in and impaneled a new grand jury impaneled on Friday, at least in part to follow up this new development. Scooter Libby's lawyers are saying that this disproves the Fitzgerald's contention that Libby was the source of the leaks. But that's not what Libby was indicted for. Libby was indicted for lying to the grand jury, and which he did. And his lies had nothing to do with whether somebody else leaked the information first. It had to do with whether he leaked the information to several journalists, and the proof is conclusive that it did. So it's not going to help Scooter Libby's defense. The question is, who else in the White House is culpable? And there were at least a dozen senior aides that knew Valerie Wilson's identity. I have a column of letters from readers that's coming up on Monday at workingforchange.com, and one of them is a very interesting letter from a retired military intelligence guy in Delaware who is saying that Wilson's identity, even though Lewis and Cheney and these other White House aides had the security clearance to learn the identity of a covert operative, it was still illegal for them to know it and to bandy it about, because that information is kept on a need-to-know basis by the CIA. And there's just no conceivable reason why the vice president, for example, should need to know the identity of a covert CIA operative. In this case, he wanted to find it out for a political smear campaign, which is not a legitimate use of that information. So even though they had security clearances, they're probably also guilty of that crime.
All right. Well, moving along, the federal budget process appears to be moving forward and making some serious cuts.
Yeah, the House passed by two votes the budget proposal that was put off from last week. Gave the Republicans time to twist some arms. Originally, 22 Republicans voted against it. In the final vote, only 14 did, so they got 8 Republicans to swing over to the White House's side, and that enabled the budget to pass by 2 votes, 217 to 215. And that's really unfortunate. There's $49.9 billion worth of cuts, primarily in social services, Medicare, Medicaid, services for the poor, etc. At the same time, there are several different tax cuts for the wealthy that are embedded in the proposal as well. So it's a very upfront case of taking from the poor and giving to the rich. Now, that budget has to be reconciled with the Senate version, which has only, and I use that word very loosely, only $35 billion worth of cuts, as opposed to 50 for the House version. So that will go to committee now, and that will have to be hammered out before the end of the year. So there's still time to urge legislators in the conference committee, and then back in the House and the Senate when they approve the negotiated version, to restore some of those cuts to social services. And people should make their voices known.
All right. Moving along, the Patriot Act appears to be a sticking point where the Democrats are putting up somewhat of a stink on.
Yeah, the Patriot Act runs out at the end of the year on December 31st. And so the House and the Senate are now in a conference committee to try and reconcile differences in the House and Senate versions of the extensions to the Patriot Act. The biggest difference is that the House version extends the Patriot Act for 10 years, while the Senate only extends it for 4 before it has to come back again with sunset provisions. Negotiators are they tried to split the difference at 7 years, but there are some other things that hung them up. So they're deadlocked right now. They've got to come back. Senate is off for a 2-week break right now over the Thanksgiving holidays, and then the following week. So in December they'll have to come back and they'll have to hammer that out. That again is a thing where we should contact legislators and let them know that, well, first of all, that we don't want the Patriot Act extended at all, but if it is going to be extended, it should be for as short a period of time as possible.
All righty. And then you had talked about last week the Graham Amendment.
Yeah, the Graham Amendment was the amendment to the budget bill in the Senate that basically suspends habeas corpus for the Guantanamo Bay prisoners and for other people who are being held in the various points in the CIA gulag system in Eastern Europe and other prisons outside the U.S. shores. About 200 of the Guantanamo Bay prisoners now have cases in federal court where they're trying to find out the reasons why they're being held, why they're in detention. They've never been told. They've not been charged with any crime. They're not, according to the Bush administration, prisoners of war. They simply have no status. They've been thrown in cells, tortured, and they have no recourse and no contact with the outside world. A Supreme Court ruling last year opened the door for these court cases, and what the Graham Amendment does is shut that door again. It overturns the Supreme Court decision. Well, on Monday, Jeff Bingham, a Democrat from New Mexico, offered an amendment that would have taken out the provision that suspended habeas corpus for these prisoners, and it failed on a straight party line vote. So it's a really, really dangerous precedent because it's the first time since, I believe, the Japanese-American internments of World War II, that habeas corpus has been suspended in the United States for any reason whatsoever. And, of course, the Japanese-American internments are now considered a black spot on American history. They're considered an outrage. This is not a precedent that we want to be emulating, but that's where it stands right now. That has to go through the House. The House is considered likely to approve it, and then it will go to Bush's desk, and he will sign it.
I believe I read this week that in several articles that the number of detentions of similar things to people at Guantanamo, as well as people in Iraq, Afghanistan, was at a number, official number of around, it was over 80,000, somewhere between 81,000 and 85,000.
Yeah, it's huge. And, as I say, most of those people have no recourse to any kind of due process whatsoever. They're not being considered prisoners of war. The Red Cross is not being allowed in to see them. Allegations of torture from former prisoners are widespread. A number of prisoners in Guantanamo have been on hunger strikes for a while now. The suicide rate is very high. And you can see why, because these people have no prospect of being let out anytime soon. They're in hell, and this is not what America should stand for. This is something that everybody should be outraged about.
All right, moving along, Alito's push for the Supreme Court appears to have hit another road bump.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's a road bump or not, because Republicans certainly aren't worried about it. But his job application in 1985 for a job in the Reagan White House was released this week, and it had a number of troubling elements. Probably the most troubling was embedded in the essay that Alito wrote, in which he was touting his Republican conservative bona fides. And one of the things that he said was that he does not believe there's a constitutional right to an abortion. This and various other statements that he made in the application about various other precedents that he does not respect are being spun by the White House as, well, yes, these are his personal views. These aren't the views of Alito, the judge, and Alito as a judge has a respect for the iron rule of precedent that overrides his personal views. This is exactly the line that Clarence Thomas used during his nomination when a lot of the views came out about his political and ideological views on the bench. He said at the time that he wouldn't act on these views because he had too much respect for precedent, and that statement was pretty much taken at face value. His nomination was very controversial, but for other reasons, having to do primarily with the sexual harassment of Anita Hill. And from the very first week that Thomas got onto the Supreme Court, he started voting to overturn precedents, and he's been doing it ever since. And I think this is exactly the situation that we have with Alito. If these are his personal beliefs, he's going to vote on them. He's going to vote to overturn Roe v. Wade. He's going to vote to overturn civil rights legislation. He's going to vote to make it very hard for workers in the workplace to address discrimination of any kind, whether it's minorities or women or whatever it is. He's going to make it very favorable conditions for corporations when corporate issues come before the Supreme Court. I mean, these are things that we know from his 15 years on the federal bench how he's going to rule on the bench. We now know what his personal beliefs are on a lot of these issues, and what they add up to is a very, very reactionary judge. He would be an absolute disaster on the Supreme Court. And I've really been disappointed and somewhat mystified that there hasn't been more opposition to Alito. I had a column about him in the Weekly this week, and I've been getting a lot of letters from Democrats and from progressives saying, why are you being so hard on this guy? I'm being hard on him because everything that we know about him suggests that he's going to be a very, very conservative ideologue on the Supreme Court, that he has a great deal of deference to people in power, and he has a great deal of hostility toward people who are not in power. And this is something, given the balance of power on the Supreme Court, given the fact that we already have several other ideologues on the Supreme Court, and it's basically a 4-4 split, where he will be the deciding vote, or his seat, Sandra O'Connor's seat, will be the deciding vote, the swing vote. His nomination has got to be stopped. His hearings begin on January 9th. There will be a vote in the Senate toward the end of January. So we have basically a couple of months to mobilize opposition. And I think right now it's got to be the highest priority in the nation for progressive activists.
All right, let's jump over then to international and This Week in Iraq. This Week in Iraq.
A lot of things happening this week in regard to the Iraq war, many of them not in Iraq, and certainly the most notable was kicked off by Bush's Veterans Day speech a week ago yesterday, in which he lambasted Democrats for having the temerity to actually criticize Bush's decisions and information in the run-up to the war. And there's been a war of words that has been going on ever since. The administration has been lashing out very hard and very consistently at Democrats, saying they're rewriting history, saying they're being irresponsible, not necessarily denying any of their charges. If you listen very closely, they're irresponsible, but they're not lying. another turning point came on Thursday when Representative John Murtha from Southwest Pennsylvania, a Democrat but probably the most conservative pro-war Democrat in the House. He's been on the Armed Forces Committee for something like 25 years. Never met a Pentagon budget request that he didn't like. Very much of a hawk. Very highly respected among his his colleagues, surprised everybody when he not only came out against the war and against the Bush administration's misleading use of intelligence in the run-up to the war, but he came out for immediate withdrawal of troops. And actually, not quite immediate. He wants to do it as a stand-down over the next 6 months. And that took the White House by surprise. And it was a really pivotal moment, I think, because of who it came from, because it came from somebody with so much credibility in the defense community. And so he now is very much a target of Bush and White House spin. You've had Cheney and other people questioning his patriotism. I mean, this is a guy who's a decorated veteran, who was in the Marine Corps for God knows how many years, something like 35. I mean, he has a lot of credibility on these issues, and he's really been the first major Democrat, the first Democrat who has a lot of pull on the White House and on Capitol Hill, to come out for immediate withdrawal of troops, which is something a fairly large segment of the public wants. What has been missing is leading Democrats coming out and echoing that call, and it's starting to come around. You had John Edwards and John Kerry in the last week and a half or so, both coming out and saying that their votes for the war were a mistake, and they think we need to get out. The Democrats are starting to find their voice, and they're starting to talk about what we need to do next, which is something that the White House never talks about. The White House does not have an exit strategy. They talk about victory, but they don't even define victory, let alone have a strategy for achieving it. And so this is a debate that's not going to go away. It's only going to get more heated. A lot of the personal attacks are really unfortunate, but I think that's what we've come to expect from this White House. And I really think that the Democrats just need to keep hammering away both at the lies of this administration in the run-up to the war, and for the fact that the war has been prosecuted in a stunningly incompetent manner, and that right now it's a mess in Iraq. It is a threat to the security of the United States. The terrorist threat is much graver today than it was 3.5 years ago. And the creation of untold tens of thousands of new jihadists who basically were recruited by our invasion of Iraq and our actions once we got there has really been a serious threat to our security. So we need to get out. And the fact that there are some Democrats now who are starting to talk about that, and even a few Republicans that are starting to talk about that, is very good news. It's a debate that needs to happen and will continue to happen. While that was going on, there were some other interesting developments this week as well. Louise Arbour, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, came out this week and said that there needs to be an international investigation of the allegations of torture by the Iraqi government. This is something that we've talked about on this program. Last week, 173 detainees were discovered in the Interior Ministry, many of whom were emaciated, many of whom bore signs of torture, and a lot of people have been calling for an international investigation, not an investigation by the Iraqi government, which is widely considered to be corrupt, widely considered to be in a CYA mode, but it needs to be an independent international investigation, and this is something that the Bush administration needs to get behind as well. Of course, we all know what they think of torture, so it's probably not likely to happen. We had also Pentagon investigators this week referred their investigation of Halliburton and of price gouging on no-bid contracts from 2003. They have now referred that to the Department of Justice for prosecution. That was an interesting development this week. So we may be hearing more about the culpability of Halliburton. That is, of course, if Alberto Gonzalez's Justice Department sees fit to prosecute it, which, you know, is a kind of an open question. But that information has been passed on to the DOJ for criminal investigation. So that was a That was a good development. Bush, of course, was in South Korea at an APEC meeting this week. He's still there, in fact, and he's been using his trip and using his public statements in Asia once again to criticize Democrats. He's done it a couple times now before military audiences on bases, which is sort of a violation of tradition that you don't use speeches before active armed forces members for political purposes, but that's exactly what he's been doing. But once he got to South Korea, aside from the usual demonstrations that were awaiting for him there, he ran into another rude surprise, which is the president of South Korea announced that next year they were going to cut their coalition troops down from 3,200 to 1,000. So a two-thirds reduction in the troops from the South Korean contingent. The coalition of the willing has been getting smaller and smaller and smaller. Poland's going to pull out at the end of the year. Italy has been reducing its troops. There have been a number of the countries that were originally in there who are no longer in there, or who have very, very token contingencies in the coalition. It's primarily Britain and the United States at this point. The question of how long those two forces are going to be in Iraq is of course also an open question. A couple developments on Capitol Hill this week. On Tuesday, the Senate voted 79 to 19 that they wanted quarterly reports from the White House about the progress of the Iraq War and about the progress toward either victory or withdrawal. This is something that the Senate has never required before. Remarkably enough. So that really was a vote from members of both parties for greater accountability from this White House as to how it prosecutes the war, which is again a sign that the White House is very much on the defensive and facing a lot of questions from members even members of its own party at this point. They're in a very weak, very defensive mode, and of course when bullies get into that position, what they do is lash out, which is one reason why you're seeing so many personal attacks against Democrats and so much name calling. Let's see, we had of course we had the usual bombings and killings over in Iraq itself this week. Yesterday,
we're just about out of time. The other thing,
okay.
Second it real quick was the white phosphorus.
That, yes, I was getting to that. Mm-hmm. Yesterday we had 74 people dying in eastern Iraq near the border with Iran in a suicide bomb, and then finally we had a couple of developments on the white phosphorus issue this week. Of course, last week, Italian state television aired a documentary alleging the use of white phosphorus as an offensive weapon during the battle in Fallujah. Pentagon immediately denied it. Then when further evidence came out that they used it, they said, well, we used it, but only as a flare for illumination. But there were a couple of other interesting developments this week on that that were discovered as a result of the Italian documentary. Field Artillery Magazine, which is basically a trade publication for U.S. soldiers, has an article in it that's a first-person account by a soldier in Fallujah that mentions using white phosphorus as an offensive weapon. There was also an article in the North County News in suburban San Diego that again quoted an active Army personnel about the offensive use of white phosphorus in shake-and-bake operations against insurgents. This is something that's a violation of the Geneva Conventions. It's a violation of the prohibition of the use of chemical weapons. And the irony, of course, is that we went in there because of allegations of weapons of mass destruction. Iraq didn't have any, but now we're using them, and that's bad news.
All right. Talking once again with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And in addition to telling people where they can find Eat the State, I understand that you're starting a fund drive here.
Yes, we are. Actually, we've got a couple things going on. We're also on Monday starting a new blog, which I'll be contributing to pretty regularly every day. The blog itself is up, and there should be a link from the homepage of www.eatthestate.org. So we'll be starting that up this week. And then we're starting up our year-end fundraising drive. course, Eat the State is a volunteer organization, newspaper that that puts out issues every other week. We cover the sort of news that you hear on this program. Marie and I both write for and edit the publication. We have a lot of volunteers who help put it out, but we're chronically short on money. And the last time we did a fundraising drive in June, July, we didn't raise nearly our goal. So we have about a $2,000 debt to the printer right now. So we can really use year-end donations. We're having premiums this time. For $50, you can choose between Paul Loeb's book, The Impossible Will Take a Little While. You can get a DVD from George Galloway's appearance at UW this past fall, or you can get a tape from Alternative Radio. We've set that up with David Barsamian. You can get one of those for a $50 donation, two of those for a $100 donation, but any donation of any size is very welcome. You can donate through PayPal at the eatthestate.org website, or you can send it to P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145. And again, you can get Eat the State wherever you find your publications, cafes, bookstores, places like that, or on the web. That's where all of our back issues are. That's where our current issue is, at www.eatthestate.org.